This is Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. Today, we travel to Hawkins, Indiana. Just where is Hawkins, Indiana? Is it Russia? Is it in a lab? I'm not sure. We'll find out with NPR's TV and film critic Eric Deggans to get the latest on Stranger Things and the role that Indiana has in Hollywood. But before that, we have reports of over 50 migrants dead in Texas. Title 42 still in effect, and the Indiana Attorney General is suing President Joe Biden for his immigration policy. What does that mean for the state of Indiana? We'll find out from Alfredo Estrada, an immigration rights attorney here on Regionally Speaking. But first, the news. This is Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. Joining us here on the phone line now is Alfredo Estrada, partner with the law firm Burke, Constanza, and Carberry, an immigration attorney as well. Alfredo, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Hey, so immigration is a hot topic once again. And, of course, the tragic news just a few days ago, an abandoned semi-truck was discovered in which several bodies were found when an employee of a nearby work site had opened it and discovered several dead migrants in the trailer of the abandoned semi-truck. We now have over 50 dead in San Antonio, Texas. And as of about midnight, Reuters was reporting that two Mexicans were in custody, two Mexican nationals were in custody following the abandonment of that trailer, that semi-truck trailer. And then, of course, news as well coming out earlier today that Title 42 is still in effect, the policy put forth by then-President Donald Trump to stop immigration over the Mexico-America southern border, and because of COVID policies to force people to remain in Mexico or remain wherever they are trying to immigrate from. So a lot of news there happening. And of course, an article just coming out just a few days ago as well. The main reason that I think we had reached out to you, Alfredo, was from the New York Times. The court widens the scope of deportations, and wanted to get you on the call here to go ahead and talk about all of these things that seem to be happening at a breakneck pace when it comes to immigration, specifically here in Indiana and the country as a whole, as much as we can talk about some of that other information. So, Alfredo, let's go ahead and jump right into it. The court widening the scope of deportations, what does that mean in the broad scheme of immigration right now in the country?
Yeah, well, that article was written in response or in reporting a Fifth Circuit case where the state of Texas and Louisiana sued the federal government, and Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland, Department of Homeland Security, and it's Mayorkas issued a policy memorandum on having and prioritizing the deportation of certain unlawful immigrants here in the United States. And this is not rare. Obama had a similar policy when it was in his administration. Trump reversed it and had his own policy. And then Biden quickly, for his administration through Mayorkas, issued priorities for his administration of deportation. And there was generally three categories: threats to national security, threats to public safety, and then those who threaten the border security. Threats to national security are those who are terrorists or espionage, and the threats to border security are those who recent arrivals that are generally the ones that they're talking about. And where the Fifth Circuit examined was the second prong of that, the threats to public safety, and then administrations or the DHS's expansion of what that means in relation to 1226A and 1226C.
So really quick, the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, what is, for our listeners, what is 1226A? What is 1226C?
So I'm getting 1226A is a statute that says the department may detain individuals throughout its deportation process, except to the limiting factors in 1226C, which goes through shall detain individuals who commit aggravated felonies as one of those the subsections.
Okay, so really quick, let me make sure I understand. So in 1226A, the Department of Homeland Security may detain people except when they shall detain because of crimes that those individuals may have committed or are accused of committing. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Or have been found guilty of.
Got it. Okay.
And so what the state of Texas argued is that the policy memorandum shifting priorities of detention for those with criminal convictions, mostly, goes against 1226C, N.A., for that matter. And the argument's well taken. It's a shall under 1226C. So I think what comes out of this Fifth Circuit case is that there may be a new policy memorandum addressing the first prong of the priority, national security, a reiteration of the second prong for those with criminal history, and then keeping the third prong, those who are new to the country or have been apprehended by a border near the border. I don't believe this is something that's going to drastically affect deportation or the prosecutorial discretion that officers and ICE attorneys have for a long period of time. It was remanded to DHS to review the policy memo, and they have the right to put forward another one. The issue going forward is going to be whether that policy memo is going to have to go through the Administrative Procedure Act. And with what Texas argued was, if you are going to substantively differ from the statute, one, Congress needs to act. But if it's a rule where you're substantively changing a statute or interpreting the statute other than from its plain language, such as in 26D with the shall, you have to go through the EIPA rulemaking process with notice and comment period. So it'll be interesting. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
It'll be interesting to see how Mayorkas and DHS respond to this. The implementation of the policy previous to the Fifth Circuit was that ICE officers, just like police officers, if you got pulled over, they have the discretion whether to issue a speeding ticket or not, right? Or,
right.
You know, make that decision. Here with ICE, it was the same. If it's your grandma with four U.S. citizen kids and they don't believe that that's a person of interest to put in deportation proceedings, they could not arrest her. And at the attorney level, there was a review process for all cases pending of whether individuals warranted prosecutorial discretion under the Mayorkas memo. And that was a process that was helping a lot of immigrants and a lot of U.S. citizen families, for that matter, to dismiss their cases because of certain criteria, one being health issues to U.S. citizen kids or spouses or parents, time here in the country, lack of criminal history, things of that nature, that it made more sense not to go through deportation proceedings because individuals relied on it. Right now, that process has been halted within the Chicago district, deportation district. I got notice of that today, and we're awaiting a new policy memo from DHS office.
So when the widening the scope of the deportation, Alfredo, I have to wonder, that dragnet then is going to catch more people just in general, regardless if they've committed crimes or they're only in the country for the last few weeks, they don't really have ties here yet. Is that the case, or is the process itself less catching? Getting people caught up that don't need to be caught up with it.
I think the title is a bit of misleading in that, the ICE officer is not going to have those policy guidelines to go through its discretion. They inherently have them. and how they use them has always been something they had. What it doesn't recognize is that DHS is extremely limited in resources to actually go out and obtain and apprehend undocumented Americans. The focus still will be on undocumented Americans in custody. That's easy for them to obtain, right, through immigration detainer requests, and individuals that they apprehend at work sites. It's not this Fifth Circuit case shouldn't be construed at that it gives ICE the resources or the authority to intensify apprehension of undocumented Americans. It just takes away priorities that the administration implemented.
We're talking with Alfredo Estrada, the immigration attorney and partner for the law firm Burke, Constanza, and Carberry here on Regionally Speaking. And an article coming out just a few days ago in the New York Times, the court widens the scope of deportations and what that means here for people across the country as well as here in Indiana. Alfredo, this might be, I don't know if this is really on your radar, it's from a few days ago, that Indiana agriculture groups are pushing for action on farm work legislation due to rising labor shortages. Is there any sort of tie-in? We saw a lot of President Trump's ICE, I don't want to call them raids, but I can't think of another word, really, where they would basically raid a place of employment. And whether it was, you know, a dairy producer for milk, or if it was a meatpacking factory or something else, that ICE was raiding these places of work. And at the time, there wasn't a labor shortage, but we're now facing one. Is this something that employers have to be worried about if hiring people?
Employees always have to be worried about hiring undocumented. There's, you know, individuals who don't have authorization to work here legally, you know, can't work here legally. But as you know, Tom, there's a black market for labor, not only here in Indiana, but also throughout the United States that's not recognized generally within our immigration policy. You know, I've been aware of the labor shortage for these farmers within Indiana for years. And I think it's this pushing for relief through the immigration process is a recognition, finally, that our dairy, our chicken, our canned tomatoes here in Indiana, our corn, is farmed by undocumented workers. And with the labor shortage, I think this might be a time where, you know, Congress can finally address the issue, and with organizations similar to those pushing it, it begs for addressing the black market of labor here in the United States.
The federal guest worker program was first approved by Congress in 1986, and that allows for agriculture employers to hire workers from other countries on, as we might call them, temps, but temporary work permits for farm jobs that last 10 months or less, which obviously most farm jobs tend to, because they are cyclical in terms of the nature of the work needed. And so it's something that does Congress have a pulse on this right now, or are they still trying to figure out and handle what's happening here with Title 42 as a federal judge has ruled that to remain intact?
Yeah, you know, we got to address immigration on all factors, right? There's the border issues. There's national security issues. There are also issues with here at home and that affect Americans' daily lives and the millions of undocumented here. I wouldn't think an expansion of temporary work visas would address the labor shortage we have. It really doesn't solve anything. The process to get individuals here working legally is a long process. And I think a better solution would be to address the amount of undocumented we have here and allow them to work. And that would resolve our labor shortage. I'm not sure what Congress has the pulse on. The last immigration we had, every reform we had from Congress was 1997. And there's been talks, of always talks, within political campaigns of addressing immigration. But that seems to be the only time that individuals have a pause for immigration. Otherwise, they ignore it.
Yeah, Alfredo, and you say that during election campaigns. What happened to the caravan, right? That caravan that was coming up to the southern borders. President Trump was running for re-election, and, you know, the caravan this, the caravan that, and, you know, all of these illegal immigrants are going to come into the country and they're going to take your jobs away. Is immigration a boogeyman, a political boogeyman for people?
To a certain extent, for sure, and in essence, close, right? We did have caravans afterwards, but it was from Afghanistan and Ukraine because of war.
Mm-hmm.
At the southern border, I've had many clients from Ukraine come to the southern border seeking asylum. There was a quick reaction to allowing them not only legal status, but entry at the southern border because of what's going on at home. When previously, with Title 42 still in effect, right? They're saying because of COVID, we can't allow certain immigrants in, but I have Ukrainian clients coming in pretty easily through humanitarian parole and other ways. So, you know, it is a boogeyman, and it's not implemented equally to the realistic views of what's happening in the world. So, you know, we'll see where it goes here within the near future. I would imagine that we're going to see more litigation and less in the same amount of inaction from Congress.
We're talking with Alfredo Estrada, immigration attorney and partner at the law firm Burke, Constanza & Carberry, here on Regionally Speaking about the latest on ICE and immigration and the impacts it has, not only on the southern border, but on all of the borders surrounding us here in Indiana. And one of those big stories that just came out earlier this week, Alfredo, was the lawsuit filed by Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita, a Munster native, filed in the U.S. District Court of Northern Indiana, suing President Joe Biden, claiming the current administration's immigration policies are becoming a drain on Hoosier taxpayers, which will only worsen as more people cross into the country's southern border. Rokita claims through the lawsuit that a growing number of fentanyl overdoses and a supposed influx of sex offenders in the country are both tied to a record number of immigrants entering the United States on a daily basis. I got to wonder, is there really merit to Attorney General Rokita's lawsuit against Biden, or is this just, again, another sort of a boogeyman slash frivolous lawsuit?
I put it in this spectrum of Attorney Rokita running for governor. You know, I really don't understand the lawsuits from an Indiana perspective. If he thinks it's a concern as attorney general, he has the right to file it, and I'll concede that. But there's other ways the state could address those issues, and not only that, but the undocumented Hoosiers in the state. So that's all I have to say about that.
I think that's fair enough. We're talking with Alfredo Estrada, former steel worker and sitting on the Lake County Bar Association Board of Managers, as well as an adjunct professor at Purdue Northwest teaching immigration law. And I actually kind of want to get into some of that discussion about what the teaching of immigration law is like. But I know that quickly, and I don't know how much you can speak on this, but the city of Gary and the welcoming city ordinance of which you authored is actually facing a lawsuit at the Indiana State Supreme Court. Are you able to make any comments on that, or is this still an ongoing case?
Yeah, I didn't appear on the case, but I did draft the ordinance, and I listened to oral arguments on the transfer, petition to transfer to the Supreme Court. I think one particular issue there's a few particular issues that are really interesting. One of grave importance and really important to the state of Indiana is the discussion of whether the Supreme Court, like the Indiana Court of Appeals, has acknowledged that local officials who accept the detainer notice from a officer of immigration. So the detainer notice is a voluntary request that you hold this individual for 48 hours, even if he posted bond. That process is a Fourth Amendment violation. And our sheriffs and our chief of police and our police departments, the sheriff departments are going to have to be very aware of this determination, because if they get these detainer requests, they're going to have to deny them from ICE or risk a Fourth Amendment lawsuit in violating their constitutional rights. I think that's going to be particularly important for us to watch of whether the Supreme Court finds that, because it may circumvent some analysis on the ordinance by doing so. Another particular issue is whether the particular sanctuary city ban statute under Indiana law actually creates standing versus a cause of action. And the standing is a theory that an individual was harmed, therefore they can sue based upon that harm, rather than a cause of action is allowing an individual to sue based upon a statute. And there was some good discussion. As you know, the lead plaintiff, or you may know, the lead plaintiff is from Vincent, Indiana, who is suing on the Gary Welcome City Ordinance. Totally opposite ends of the state, but he has supposedly standing to sue the city of Gary. So I think it'll be interesting to watch, particularly if there's a Fourth Amendment violation found by adhering to the detainer request. If that occurs, I think it would be a huge win for undocumented Hoosiers in finding that they have that particular constitutional right when it comes to those detainer requests. And it's important to know that there's only really three subsections of the Welcome City Ordinance, which was about 12 pages, that's of issue. So the Indiana Court of Appeals decision was a huge win. If we lose on three subsections, the 99% of the ordinance is still intact and going to be useful for Gary residents.
Alfredo, really quick before we get into that last part of the conversation about the education for immigration law, and maybe this is through the fault of myself in terms of the way that some of the questions were phrased, but I feel like oftentimes when we talk about immigration, it's often with a lens or a scope on the southern border. And we don't typically think of immigration from Canada to the south. We don't think of immigration from Europe over into America. But you did make mention of the fact that you have almost no problem getting people in from Ukraine who are fleeing war-torn countries. But at the same time, people in Mexico and South and Central and Southern America are also fleeing war-torn and gang-ridden countries. Can you kind of give me a sort of a broader scope, a broader lens of what does immigration in Indiana look like when it comes to people coming from, whether it's the Philippines, Burma, India, China, et cetera?
Yeah, generally, most of the European and Asian immigrants here in the region are here on tourist visas or maybe F-1 visas, student visas, or some type of legal entry. And then, the standard or generic case is that they find someone that they want to marry, and it happens to be a U.S. citizen. So that's generally what occurs here in the region. There are a lot of influx of Macedonians. There's a great amount of Macedonian Serbians and Indian populations here in the region are very diverse in that matter. But, the diversity of our region, not only here, but Fort Wayne has a huge population of refugees going there because the city welcomes them and includes them in their community. But across the state, the diversity of those types of immigrants really needs us to focus on, for the state level, on immigration, how to incorporate that workforce, how to incorporate their knowledge and talent, particularly in a labor shortage, to help Indiana. And if we could do so, such as giving them driver's license, excuse me, we should.
Yeah, and there's actually there's a Senate bill, right? Senate bill, is it 200 or 500 that is encouraging the licensing of immigrants to go ahead and kind of keep a record on them and be able to get them insured, right? That's through the Indiana Senate. Did that get passed this past legislative session?
It didn't get passed. It was up for it's been up a few times and never received a hearing. From my understand, talking through some senators I know downstate, it's finally going to get a hearing this coming up session to discuss.
So we'll have to wait and see on that one. And as we wrap up our conversation with Alfredo Estrada, immigration attorney and partner of the law firm Burke, Constanza, and Carberry, you are an adjunct professor at Purdue Northwest teaching immigration law. I gotta think, as if you're a student of yours, if you're a current law student, there's a lot of legal precedent to go ahead and take a look at when it comes to immigration law. What is that process like in teaching lawyers who, or soon-to-be lawyers, I guess, who may not necessarily be interested in immigration law, but, you know, have to take the class for the course credits and whatnot? What's that process like for them? Is it an eye-opening experience? Have you heard stories of students going back and saying, you know what, I think this is my true calling. This is what I want to do?
You know, it's been a good experience. It's been a bucket list thing. I'm a graduate of Purdue Northwest. And so the undergraduate class I teach is kind of... takes me back home, right, to be a resource to not only students who are majority there at Purdue Northwest, first-generation students of undergraduate or undergraduate degrees, similar to me when I went, and working students similar to me when I went. So it's been a good experience. I do find that a lot of my students are interested in immigration, are connected to immigration through family experience or friends. And then, of course, like any class, those who just need the credit. But the response has been great. It's interesting to get the reaction on certain aspects of immigration that they didn't know about. But, you know, it's a passion of mine, so I wanted to share it with those who wanted to become attorneys.
Alfredo Estrada, immigration attorney, and again, partner with the law firm Burke, Constanza, and Carberry, joining us here on Regionally Speaking. I know we covered a lot of stuff. Is there anything else that we sort of left off, no pun intended, the docket when it comes to immigration here in Indiana and the Chicagoland area?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the tragedy down near the southern border of the 50 individuals who are dead due to human trafficking is a reality we live in. And policies like Title 42 that require immigrants to wait abroad for their due process hearing simply, and the rhetoric that support those policies are going to lead to, unfortunately, more instances of illegal immigration and, unfortunately, abuses like we've seen and the horror we've seen. 50 individuals dead here recently. So not to say that it's something that we can predict, but undoubtedly when you make it harder to immigrate to the United States legally, individuals are going to find ways to illegally immigrate, and they're going to become victims of things.
And I think we're going to have to leave it there at that point. Alfredo, thank you so much for your time here on Regionally Speaking. And looking forward to the next time we talk, though I hope under happier circumstances.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking. We'll be getting into our conversation with NPR TV critic Eric Deggans next on the return to Hawkins, Indiana in Stranger Things. Joining us now on Regionally Speaking is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, of course, the big news for a lot of TV fans right now, and especially on Netflix, coming up on Friday, July 1st, Stranger Things, the next installment of the final season releases. And I know that you are a really, really, really big fan of Stranger Things, so I'm going to ask you this question. Have you ever been to Hawkins, Indiana?
Does it exist? I thought Hawkins was a fictional town.
Well, you're right. It is a fictional town, and so you know, I wonder, you know, what is the draw for Indiana for a TV show like Stranger Things? And that conversation, I guess, in my head, the question started to bubble up, and I figured, who better than to bring on than NPR's own Eric Deggans? And Eric, so what is it about Stranger Things? Because, you know, you think of Indiana, you don't really think of ties to Russia in the 1980s and secret alien monsters and lab creations, right?
Right. Well, and you know, just to remind everybody, or to let people know, you know, I grew up in Gary and I graduated from Indiana University in Bloomington. So I spent the first, you know, 20, 25 years of my life in Indiana. And I think Hollywood uses Indiana as a shorthand for a kind of suburban slash rural kind of environment that is mostly meant to mean sort of Midwestern and not a city, not a big city. So there are a lot of TV shows that are supposedly set in Indiana, but none of them film there, and they don't really sort of incorporate any sort of culture from the state. It's just more kind of a way to tell people, you know, it's not L.A., it's not New York, it's not Miami, it's not New Orleans. It's this sort of generic Midwestern kind of city. And so, you know, the fact that Hawkins is fictional gives them even more leeway to, I mean, you know, Stranger Things is filmed in Georgia. So, you know, they don't film it. They don't even film it in Indiana. So, you know, it doesn't even necessarily, I mean, the places that they frequent on the show don't even necessarily resemble many areas of Indiana that I've lived in, except maybe Brown County, you know, maybe. I think it's more like trying to evoke an attitude, you know, a type of a place for audiences that mostly don't know anything about Indiana.
Yeah, it's a more small town USA when you think of shows like Parks and Rec and, you know, Pawnee, Indiana, and their biggest rival is Muncie. And I went to Ball State, and I tell you what, if your biggest rival is Muncie, you've got some problems there, Pawnee.
Yeah, and, you know, like, why would it be? I mean, I'm sure they chose Muncie because it's a funny sounding name, but I mean, why wouldn't your biggest rival be, you know, Indianapolis, which is not that far away,
right? Or even Bloomington or West Lafayette, you know, some place that it's
exactly.
Like
exactly. Yeah, but exactly. But so they were choosing a place that had kind of a funny name, and even if you know Muncie, you get that's kind of a joke. But you know, when you watch Parks and Rec, again, it's not, you know, you never really get the sense that they're sort of evoking like an Indiana kind of vibe, other than a really general small town America kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, and I think the only time I feel like they were actually in Indiana is when they went to the, forgive my age here, the Hoosier Dome, now known as Lucas Oil, and a completely different building as the Hoosier Dome was demolished in the 90s. But it is, you know, they went there, you know, the actors threw on some Colts jerseys, and they made it look like, oh, yeah, we're big Colt fans here in Pawnee, Indiana. But, yeah, there's another show, and this is probably also dating me, as a an older millennial, but a show called Erie, Indiana, in which the star of the movie Hocus Pocus, Max, and I can't remember his name, but the same kind of concept where he stumbles across, you know, this this secret like waste dump, and it kind of you know, invokes all of these like really crazy things that happen, and of course, you know, Indiana being part of the old Rust Belt. Through Gary and in the South Bend before you make your way up into Michigan and make your way across over to Chicago. So definitely some tie-in there with regards to Hollywood wanting to put out a specific type of a vibe or a feel for a state. And, you know, even just across the state lines over in Illinois where Roseanne was based out of, you know, for many, many years there. And Movies like National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation and Clark Griswold wearing the Chicago Bears hat, you know, sort of invoking this Midwestern feel. Let's stay on this theme here before we dig back into Stranger Things, because I think it's really interesting, Eric, that, you know, how do the coasts, how does a New York City or an L.A. sort of view not just Indiana, but, I mean, the flyover states in general, you know, Stranger Things or Parks and Rec could have been, you know, based in Ohio or Michigan. They could have been based in Iowa or Nebraska. You know, what is it about the Midwest that sort of has that sort of that feel, or what gives the coastal communities, Hollywood, if you will, what gives them that feel of the Midwest?
Well, you know, again, I think it's the idea of an area in the Midwest that is not Chicago. So, you know, you think of Iowa, Ohio, you know, Indiana and Illinois, they call them part of the flyover states. Mm-hmm. You know, they're areas that, you know, people in show business mostly travel over in airplanes when they're going from New York to LA. And, you know, there are some people, of course, who have connections to Chicago. You know, Second City has produced a lot of comics, and so I don't think there's much of a surprise when some of those comics who've come through Second City wind up creating shows that are set in Indiana or Illinois or something like that, because they kind of remember their days mm-hmm. When they lived in the Midwest, and they're trying to evoke that in the pieces that they're creating. But again, you know, like, if you think about the film Breaking Away, now you know that's a film that's set in Bloomington, Indiana. It's built around the Little Five, you know, bicycle race that happens at Indiana University every year, and that was a movie that was filmed. That was Indiana. I mean, it was filmed in Bloomington. That was a movie that was filled with Indiana culture, and in particular Indiana University culture and Bloomington, Indiana culture. And you really had a sense when you were watching the film that they had kind of captured what was special about the city and about the students there. And you know, I have to say I'm kind of surprised that more TV shows haven't tried to really set a show in Gary, Indiana, and capture what it's like there. Or set a show in Terre Haute and capture what it's like there. Or if you're going to say a show is set in Indianapolis, you know, try to actually capture what Indianapolis is like, because these cities are all really unique and they have interesting, you know, culture, and they can sort of fuel really sort of compelling TV. But, you know, these people who are creating these shows have to take the time to go there and learn what the cities are like and even film there. And that's something that we don't often see. You know, you think about all these shows that were supposedly set in Indiana, like the Jeff Foxworthy show was set in Bloomington, Indiana, at least in its first season. One Day at a Time, the classic 70s show, was set in Indianapolis. You know, there are a lot of these kinds of shows that are supposedly set in Indiana, but they don't really take the time to sort of capture what is distinct about Indiana and what makes it different from even other Midwestern cities. And it's interesting because I live in Florida now, and I feel the same thing happens with Florida. You know, there are shows that are TV shows that are set in Florida, but they film them in Georgia or they film them in New Orleans because of the tax breaks. So, you know, the show doesn't really look like Florida. They don't really capture the unique beaches, the unique skyline, the unique, you know, temperatures, the humidity that kind of goes on. They don't really capture any of that. It's just, you know, hey, Miami is this, you know, place where crazy people live, or Miami is this place that has beaches. It you know, too often for these TV shows, a location is just kind of a generic reference to a type of a place. So, you know, if it's in Indiana, it's small town America. If it's in Florida, it's, you know, a beach community. Maybe there's an international vibe to it if it's set in Miami. You know, New York, Chicago, L.A., they all have sort of their thumbnail, you know, descriptions. But you you know, if they take the time to really capture the essence of a place, they can really make the shows different. So, I think that's something that would be a great challenge for today's TV makers. You know, set a show in Indiana and actually capture a little bit of Indiana culture when you make it.
We're talking with Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic, here on Regionally Speaking about Hollywood's view on Indiana as, of course, Hawkins gets thrown into the spotlight again, the next installment of the final season getting set to release on Friday, July 1st. Eric, so I guess building on this theme, this sort of like everywhere USA, why even call it Hawkins, Indiana? Why call it Erie, Indiana, or Pawnee, Indiana, or wherever else shows might be based on, where they're making up these sort of fake names? Why not just call it, you know, Pawnee, and you could just call it, you know, Hawkins, and not really say it's in Indiana? Therefore, you know, somebody watching it could think, oh, that's in southern Minnesota, or that's in Iowa, or that's in, you know, northern Texas, or it's in southern Indiana, or the middle of the state in Illinois. Why give that specific tie to the state of Indiana? Is it just trying to evoke those feelings of Midwesternism?
Yeah, I think so. I think the idea in sort of setting it in the state specifically is it's a thumbnail reference to a location. So, you know, they don't have to say a Midwestern town, a town that represents small town America. They don't have to give you any more descriptors. They just tell you what state it's in.
Mm-hmm.
And that automatically, they expect the viewer to kind of fill in their sense of that town with all the stereotypes that we have about Indiana towns, right? And then what they do is they don't really try to reflect like Indiana culture. So when you watch the show, your perception of it is exactly what you said. You see it as this sort of generic small town. And if you grew up in Missouri, or you grew up in Illinois, you grew up in Ohio, in some, you know, around or in a town like that, you will identify with Hawkins, Indiana, because they're not really making much of an effort to make it feel distinctly like Indiana. Mm-hmm. They're just making it feel like a small town in America. They call it Indiana so that when you first hear it, you go, oh, you know, small town in the Midwest. But then when you watch the show, you'll see it's a generic small town in the Midwest that really could be anywhere. And they could have called it Hawkins, Illinois, or Hawkins, Ohio. But I do think that there's an idea that having a sort of supernatural horror set in a place like Indiana that is considered very buttoned down, very, boring, very conservative, you know, for the most part, setting... A sort of gonzo supernatural horror story in a state like that, you know, that's what they're trying to evoke, you know, that, you know, here's a place that could not be more American apple pie button down conservative, and yet, you know, Demogorgons are coming out of the walls, you know.
Right, and we saw that in the imagery, especially in season 2 or 3 when it was Halloween. And the kids from Stranger Things were walking around, and you see the yard signs for Reagan Bush for presidential elections, and it feels very, very Midwestern. They go to, you know, the local county fair.
And when I said conservative, you know, I wasn't really referring to I didn't necessarily mean politically. I meant, you know, just in terms of not a flamboyant kind of lifestyle, very kind of buttoned down, very,
tucked in flannel shirts. That kind of feeling, if you will. Now, Eric, I'll be honest, I have not watched any of season 4 yet. I am definitely a sit and binger type of viewer. And so, like, the anticipation of having to wait days and weeks for the release of the next episode, I frankly can't handle it. So I'm waiting until the entire season drops. But I do know that, you know, based on pictures I've seen on social media, the kids are a little bit bigger. They're a little bit older. Yeah. How has the storyline now taken on from just a couple of kids who wanted to play some D&D in a basement years ago, all of a sudden turned into essentially trying to stop the Red Army, it feels like, with these Demogorgons.
Well, what's interesting, when you've been covering TV as long as I have, you can tell that a long-running TV show that is based on an ensemble of characters goes through a cycle. So the first thing that happens is that the storylines establish the group as a family, as a de facto family. And so the early seasons are about forging that bond and uniting them as a group. And that's what we saw kind of happen up until now. Now what has happened is as the fourth season starts, the group is split up. You know, Eleven has been adopted by Winona Ryder's character, and they've moved out of state. And so she's going to high school in a different state and really struggling. She's how cruel kids can be. And, she's not really accepted, but she's trying to put on a brave front for her boyfriend who stayed in Indiana and who she wants to think he wants her. She wants him to think that she's doing well. So everybody's sort of split up, you know. The young African-American boy is being accepted as an athlete by the popular kids, which, of course, kind of cuts him off from all his friends who are all nerds. The two of the other kids get more involved in a really intense Dungeons and Dragons group that kind of cuts them off from all their friends. So they're doing that classic thing where they take the group that had been united as a family and they are splitting them up, and they are playing with the tensions of what it means to have this group of kids who were united by trauma and adventure, and splitting them up and having them sort of deal with, oh my God, you know, my family is now not as close as I want it to be. And of course, there's a connection to the Russians that I don't really want to say if you haven't seen the new episodes, because there's still a connection to them. And we're going to find out that character that we thought was dead is not dead. So all of that kind of has to be resolved in the fourth season. And, we've got two episodes dropping on July 1st, and they're going to be huge episodes. The last one is going to be 90 minutes. So it really is going to feel like sort of a third of a season kind of dropped almost.
Yeah.
And they have a lot. They have a lot of storyline to kind of make up for, because, you know, the team had come back together. But they're facing a serious challenge, and we find out a little bit more about the origin of the Upside Down, a little bit more about the origin of the new villain that's inside the Upside Down, and a little bit more about what our heroes will have to do, our heroes and heroines will have to do to defeat them. It's a great story. It is a little gory and grisly, and it's going to be tough for some people to watch, I think.
We're talking with Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic, here on Regionally Speaking about the latest installment of Stranger Things. Yes, based in Hawkins, Indiana. And it has everything you could ever want. D&D, monsters, and small-town Americana feel. Eric, really quick here before we wrap up the conversation and let you go. Is there any justice yet for Barb, or are we still waiting?
I think, unfortunately, they've done what they're going to do with Barb, as far as I can tell. Now, I haven't seen the episodes that are to come, and then there'll be a whole another season of the Stranger Things episodes, presumably next year, and that will be the show's final season.
Oh, so we are going to have a fifth season. Okay.
Yeah, and so, but I don't think. I don't think they're going to return to that character. I think they had kind of said what they needed to say with that character. Now, this is Stranger Things, so you never know. I mean, they might decide for the final season to try and call back to that character in some way, and I think that would be wonderful. But it feels like everything has really moved on. And, I bet there would be a lot of people watching the show now who might not even recognize or remember that character.
Right.
They did a callback.
Okay, and one last question for you, Eric. Do you have any predictions as to how season four wraps and maybe what happens in season five without, I guess, giving away too many spoilers?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, you know, and again, since you haven't seen season four, the stuff that's out now, you know, I want to be hesitant about talking about what even happens then. But, you know, Eleven's on a journey, and it's hard to tell where that journey is going to end. But at some point, she has to take responsibility for the things that she has done to create the situation that they're in. And I don't know if we're going to see that happen over the episodes that are yet to drop, or if that is the story of the next and final season. My hunch is that, you know, that's what we may see there. But at some point, there has to be a reckoning over the upside down. And how it came to be, and all of these, you know, scientists messing around with all of these kids who had special powers, you know, at some point, the tab has to be paid. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, there's a sense that the villain that they're facing now is the result of that. So in one way, that's the tab that they're paying. But I think ultimately there has to be a reckoning for everything that they did. And hopefully, you know, that's what we'll see in the next season.
Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic, joining us here on Regionally Speaking. Eric, thank you so much. And I know I got to wait a little bit longer here before I delve into season four. But maybe, just maybe, this holiday weekend, I might sit on the couch for a couple of hours and get caught back up. Great to have you here on Regionally Speaking. And
I would highly recommend that, because I think there's so much going on that it might be good to absorb it like a couple episodes at a time.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Some people love to sit down and just watch them. But then I think you get so focused on just following the plot, you know, what's happening, that you miss some of the characterizations and some of the nuances of what they're depicting. And so if you consume it a couple of episodes at a time, you can really notice some of the smaller things too, which they're really masterful at doing.
One might even call them the Stranger Things. Eric, thank you so much for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
All right. Thank you very much.